Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of March 13th, 2015. The road to comfort and prosperity is rarely an easy one for people, for nations, for technology. And often it's not particularly clear. In a place like China, for example, where government numbers aren't always reliable, a true portrait of economic life can be hard to come by. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week on the show, we've got stories that try to push through the opaque and pull back the curtain. From the Chinese economy in our special series with the BBC, to the mysteries of Scientology, and a former FBI agent reveals the secrets behind a great first impression. Turns out it's all about body language. If you want to communicate with us in written language, however, you can do that. Just visit us at marketplaceweekend.org and click on Go, or tweet us. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. This week on the show, as I mentioned, you'll hear stories about a lot of things that are slightly opaque, from the Chinese economy to a religion here in the U.S. So we're starting off the show with one thing that's sort of mysterious. It's an economy of sorts that's growing, even though it's far from clear how many people are actually contributing to it. That's what's happening on Scientology's balance sheet. In Going Clear, a new documentary from HBO, filmmaker Alex Gibney and Lawrence Wright, an author and producer, explore the history of Scientology and, most intriguingly, its complicated finances. You'll hear Alex and Lawrence in just a moment. But one disclosure before we start, representatives of Scientology have denounced the film as one-sided, dishonest, and bigoted. So how did the Church of Scientology start? I'm going to let Lawrence Wright explain.
It all began with L. Ron Hubbard, who was a science fiction writer, and he uncharacteristically wrote a book called Dianetics in 1950, which was kind of a sensation, and he made millions on that and lost them. And so he often said that the way to make money is to start a religion, and that's what he did.
Alex Gibney, you guys made an interesting choice in this movie. You sort of layered in recollections of L. Ron Hubbard's former wife, specifically recalling this moment where he says, you know, a religion is a way to make money. It seems like this was a deliberate way to evade taxation.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole scam, as he saw it, was in creating a religion, you can be tax exempt. And what better way to keep the profits?
So let's get to the basics here. How does the IRS determine whether a group is a religion? Lawrence, right? You really delved into this both in the movie and in your book.
Well, the IRS is the only agency that really makes that distinction. And it's not like there are a lot of theologians in the IRS. You know, this is, you know, a group of lawyers and accountants, but they have the authority to decide what constitutes a religion. And before he died, L. Ron Hubbard had decided not to pay his taxes. And by 1993, the Church of Scientology owed $1 billion in back taxes, and it didn't have that billion. So getting a tax exemption was an existential moment for the church. And the way they went about it was to launch 2,400 lawsuits against the IRS and individual
lawsuits.
Yes.
Yeah.
And follow, you know, they hired private investigators to follow individual agents around and try to dig up dirt on them and publish stories in the Scientology magazine. And so the deal that was struck between the IRS and the Church of Scientology is that the IRS forgave that $1 billion. It gave them an incredibly broad tax exemption that even included the novels that L. Ron Hubbard wrote. And in return, Scientology dropped those lawsuits. And since then, the fortunes of the Church of Scientology have turned around to the point that they now have about $3 billion worth of assets.
Alex, I think a lot of people know about some of the more exciting tidbits, Xenu, volcanoes, aliens. But I was struck when watching this movie how much of this is a story about money. Did you know that going in?
Not as much as I did by the time I got to the end. I mean, you know, it's really a very carefully calibrated system. There's a path you take in Scientology called the bridge to total freedom. And the way you navigate that path is by paying a lot of money. It's very carefully crafted. You know, many churches depend on tithes or, you know, people dropping money into the collection box. Scientology bakes it in to the system.
Well, later. One thing Alex points out in the documentary is that it also benefits from the labor of the Sea Org, which is the clergy, which gets paid $50 a week.
Wow.
And they work pretty much 7 days a week.
If you think about it, it's a pretty good business system. You pay your labor almost nothing. You don't have to pay taxes, and you can hoard your money. How good is that?
And you get tax-exempt properties.
Right.
I want to play a clip now from a woman named Spanky. She was a member of the church, and in the film, she says she worked closely with John Travolta, but found herself questioning the church after she had children.
I told them that I was having problems with my pregnancy and I needed to use the phone. So they sent a bodyguard with me. I called one of the few non-Scientologists I knew, a wonderful woman who happened to work for John Travolta. I said, meet me at this address. I gave her a time and I hung up. I go up to my daughter's room and I wrapped her up. And there's the bodyguard with me. I said, oh, my sister-in-law is in that car. She's going to take the baby to the doctor. He said, well, has this been approved? Of course it was approved.
That's from the HBO documentary film Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief, which debuts March 29th on HBO. Tell me a little bit about what Spanky and some of the other former Scientologists had to face when they left the church, because these repercussions were not mild.
They're still not mild. I mean, no. I think...
And go ahead and why don't you identify yourself, because your voices are a little similar.
Oh, sorry. This is Alex Gibney. You know, these abuses are still going on. All the people who are in the film, the ex-Scientologists, are being harassed today on a daily basis. Private investigators are following them. They're receiving abusive, sometimes threatening letters.
Death threats
in one case. You know, it's not a pretty picture. They go after people very hard.
When you think about the impact of this film and when you look forward, do you think the religious classification for Scientology under the IRS should end?
Well, yeah, I think it should end. But a lot of people are going to have to bring pressure to bear on the IRS to do it. And I think the reason it should end is because of the abuses. One of the things that Larry's book did and also the film did is to do an extension of what Freud would have called the talking cure. For some of these people who are into Scientology, they're now being able to speak out about the abuses, which is what the church was trying so hard to prevent. And that's giving a lot of comfort to people who are in the church, who are trying to leave, and are preventing a lot of people who might be seduced into going into the church.
I'd like to add, this is Larry, about the tax exemption. You know, when you get this 501c3 determination, you're supposed to have a series of checks and balances. Yet in 2004, the leader of the church, David Miscavige, began incarcerating, you know, the top people of the executive branch of the church. I cannot see where the checks and balances are if a single individual can take the echelon that of people that work underneath them and lock them up for long periods of time.
It's hard to understand. This is Alex now. It's hard to understand why it is that a tax exemption that effectively we subsidize should be allowed to support the use of private investigators to harass individuals, to destroy families in the name of trying to keep people from leaving the church. These are cruel, inhuman policies which are being supported by Scientology's tax exemption.
Going Clear premieres in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York on March 13th and will be broadcast on HBO March 29th. Alex Gibney and Lawrence Wright, thank you both very much.
Many thanks.
Thanks.
You can find information on the Church of Scientology's response to Going Clear by visiting our website, marketplaceweekend.org. Last week, we asked our online community how you shop and whether where a product is made matters to you. According to the U.S. Census, in 2014, the U.S. imported over $466 million in goods from China. That's nearly three times more than the U.S. exported. And that's just China. Countries like Canada, Mexico, Japan, Germany, and South Korea also top the list of U.S. foreign trade partners. Many businesses put an emphasis on local production. So you got companies like American Apparel, which tout U.S. manufacturing. And at farmers markets and cafes, vendors brag about tomatoes grown on a farm only miles away or beans roasted on the premises. Some of you tweeted Marketplace Weekend about how much it matters to you where something is made. Taj Ahmed says it's important to him and his business, and he uses and makes local products wherever possible. Mary Ruth Shields says it's important to buy goods manufactured in the U.S. And here's what some of the rest of you had to say.
A lot of the clothes that we buy, I think, are made in China and other East Asian countries like Indonesia and that sort of thing.
Do you spend your money based on where things are made?
No, I'd like to. Like, if our income was greater, we'd look at that more intensely in terms of where we're spending our money, but right now, no.
No, I don't know where my clothes are made, and I do feel some guilt about that.
I would say I probably don't pay as much attention as I should, but I assume most of my clothes are probably made overseas somewhere.
I would be willing to pay a little bit more for clothing made here in the U.S. and clothing made under, I guess, fair labor laws.
Next week, we're wrapping up our series with the BBC, Six Routes to Riches, with conversations about the U.S. economy. As always, we want to hear your stories, how you feel about the economy in the U.S. and your place in it. Write to us at marketplaceweekend.org or tweet us. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. We now turn to our special series with the BBC, Six Routes to Riches, an in-depth look at the challenges and opportunities people face as they make a living around the world. We're taking a tour of six countries at the heart of the changing global economy. Last week, we visited India, where we heard from street vendors trying to create their own safety net to ensure a path to the middle class. This week, we're in China, the second biggest economy in the world. It's a country undergoing one of the biggest economic transitions in the world, double-digit economic growth for decades, and that's led to more wealth, more consumer spending. Get this, by 2022, China's middle class could be about 630 million people. That's roughly 45% of its entire population. So what does mobility look like there, and how do you measure it in a place where economic numbers can be pretty opaque? Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz and the BBC's Linda Yu give us two contrasting portraits of moving up in the Chinese economy.
It's 3 a.m. in Shanghai, but nobody ever sleeps here. The Tongchuan Road Fish Market is Shanghai's largest, supplying the city's more than 20 million people with their staple food. Everyone here wears rubber boots. There are miles of twisting, cramped corridors, and they're covered in fish guts. It's a slimy, lively labyrinth that's difficult to navigate. It's sort of like finding one's way into China's elusive middle class. 47-year-old Zhang Wenquan knows this all too well. He's tall, muscular, and he wears a buzz cut. He grew up poor on a farm in the countryside. When he turned 17, he came to Shanghai to work on an assembly line. He met his wife at a factory, and they now sell fish at a neighborhood market. Zhang wakes up each day at midnight to buy his goods here. And buy might not be the right term. Constant haggling is more like it. How much? Zhang asks the vendor as he plunges his strong hands into a box of live shrimp. 50, the woman says. 50? Yesterday you sold them for 48. These are too small. He repeats this with every vendor. Too small, too expensive, too ugly. At one stall, he takes one look at a tank of fish and declares, they're all dead.
Buying fish is tougher than raising children. By this afternoon, everything I just bought will be dead and worthless.
His children, on the other hand, could someday be the family's ticket into China's middle class. On the drive home, he explains.
I'm not working this hard, so my daughters end up working as fish sellers like me. They've got to go to good colleges and find good jobs with good salaries.
Zhang has twin daughters, a stroke of luck in a country with a one-child policy. But that's where he sees his luck ending. His girls are 16. They were born here. Shanghai is the only home they know. Yet Zhang and his wife had to send the girls to the countryside last year so that they could finish their schooling.
They can't legally attend high school in Shanghai because they don't have Shanghai hukou.
Hukou means household registration, and if you don't have hukou for Shanghai, in other words, if you're not registered to live here, then you're not eligible for social benefits like health insurance, a pension, or even a high school education for your children. You have to return to where your family originally came from to get those things. China's modern hukou system has its roots in the country's old communist-style command economy. After the economic reforms of the 1980s, the system was relaxed to allow migrants to move into the cities. But strict rules remain governing where their children can attend school and take college entrance exams. Hukou supporters say controlling China's massive population like this has helped prevent the creation of slums around its biggest cities that are common sites in the developing world. The Zhang family hukou belongs to his wife's ancestral village in the countryside of Jiangsu province. And that's why the couple has been without their daughters for more than a year. It's now 6 in the morning. Zhang's arrived to his stall at a wet market in downtown Shanghai. He's dropped off the fresh fish, and his wife, Shi Huiqun, takes over from here so that he can go home and sleep. The 42-year-old tells me business is tougher than it's ever been.
Competition here is fierce. We used to be able to save money, but now we're paying for our daughters to attend school back in my hometown, so we're close to breaking even.
Shi and Zhang own an apartment in Shanghai, a house in the countryside, a foreign car, and they make around $15,000 a year. That's three times more than the average urban family makes in China. Yet when I ask her if she considers herself middle class, she shakes her head.
I don't think small business owners like us belong to the middle class. We don't make that much money. What is the middle class?
You know, I don't know if anybody knows what the middle class is in China.
James McGregor is author of the book 1 Billion Customers. He says the first wave of China's middle class were the 400 million people who grew up in China's largest cities and are now, on paper, upper class. They became wealthy on China's real estate boom, and they now drink Starbucks, own iPhones, and drive imported luxury cars.
Maybe the middle class is the next coming wave of the migrant workers getting legal registration in the city, getting city services, and becoming the next consumer.
In other words, there are people like Zhang and Shi at the fish market.
Actually, if you look at the studies of the future of the Chinese economy, that group of people, if you can get 10 million of them a year and they can become consumers, you can have 6% growth in China for 20 years.
And that's why China's government has launched an urbanization campaign with the goal of moving 250 million rural Chinese to the cities over the next decade. Government propaganda posters throughout the country advertise the Chinese dream, the guiding principle of President Xi Jinping's government. Back at the market, I asked Shi if she's pursuing the Chinese dream.
What's the Chinese dream? Is that something from TV? I haven't heard about it.
Instead, I ask her, what's your dream?
Originally, I dreamt that my girls could finish their schooling here in Shanghai, but that dream never came true.
Nearly half of Shanghai's 24 million residents are in the same boat as Zhang and Shi. Their children can't attend Shanghai schools because they don't have city hukou. Nationwide, it adds up to nearly a third of China's urban population, 250 million people. China's leaders have vowed to reform the hukou system, but so far, meaningful change hasn't taken place, and migrants continue to move to the country's largest cities. Today, though, Shi Huiqun is heading in the opposite direction. She's driving 2 hours north of Shanghai to her rural hometown to visit her twin daughters. Shi has rented a bare, unfurnished apartment for them next to their private middle school. The 16-year-olds have had to repeat the ninth grade because the curriculum in their new school is a year ahead of that of their old middle school in Shanghai. When we arrive, the twins are studying their textbooks side by side. Their grandmother, who can't read or write, stands guard behind them. Zhang Ming studies physics while Zhang Yue reads her English homework out loud.
Our own planet, the Earth, is becoming more and more crowded and polluted because of the rapid increase of
population.
The two are identical. They wear identical jackets and identical hairstyles. It's nearly impossible to tell them apart. But throughout our conversation, their mother recites their differences to me. Zhang Ming is ranked fourth in class, Zhang Yue is 15th. Zhang Ming's eyesight is worse, Zhang Yue is quieter. The girls nod in unison. The girls tell me school here is much more demanding than in Shanghai. They're in class from 6 in the morning until 9 at night, and they attend half days on Sundays. I ask what they think of their new school and their new home. Zhang Yue, the quiet one, answers.
I prefer to be in Shanghai. I feel like a foreigner here. I think China should allow children to attend school where they grew up. We consider ourselves Shanghaiese, but according to our hukou, we're not.
Despite what their hukou says, the family has come a long way. Down the road is the farm that Shi grew up on, a couple of acres of crops, pigs, chicken, and sheep. I grew up here in a house with a dirt floor, Shi tells me. Life is better now, but not for everyone. Hukou laws have forced parents throughout China to leave their children behind. They're called left-behind children, and there are an estimated 60 million of them, nearly as much as the entire population of the UK. Shi isn't too worried about her daughters because she and her husband aren't far away. But for most left-behind children, that's not the case. With their parents in another part of China, many of them drop out of school, all but removing an entire population of Chinese from the dream of making it into the middle class. In Jiangsu province, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Thanks, Rob. The story of the Chinese economy is about those emerging middle class families and their path to prosperity. But the story of China is also about the expansion of wealth and the entrepreneurs who've made their millions catering to the middle class. The BBC's Linda Yu has a profile of one such CEO.
It's late on a Wednesday night in a karaoke bar in an upmarket section of Shanghai. It's filled with rooms of people singing their favorite songs. Like people with a bit of money anywhere in the world, they're out enjoying themselves. But this is a class of people that barely existed in China a generation ago. 500 million people have been lifted out of poverty. It's also made the people at the top hugely wealthy. There are a million millionaires in China, and nobody epitomizes this change better than the man who owns this complex. Wang Jialing is China's richest man.
Currently, most Chinese companies are imitating. Innovative companies, be it technological innovation or business model innovation, are still lacking. Chinese enterprises are still learning. I think it might take up to 10 years or at least 8 years before Chinese companies can stop imitating their Western counterparts and become genuinely innovative.
I met him in a boardroom in a swanky hotel, dressed in a dark blue suit and tie with neat black hair. The trim 60-year-old is about as far from the laid-back pin-ups of Silicon Valley as you can imagine. Sitting straight-backed with a level gaze, Wang Jianling exudes confidence. It's not hard to imagine that China's biggest property tycoon started his career in the military, like his father before him. Like most of the generation who got rich in the 90s, he served in the People's Liberation Army before setting up his firm, Dalian Wanda, to take advantage of the developing consumer market. Rupert Hoodworth compiled the Hurong Report, an annual survey of China's wealthy. He's followed Wang Jialing's career.
Wang Jialing called the urbanization boom. So about 20 years ago, there was this huge need of people moving in from the countryside into the big cities. And that required a lot of new residences, new office blocks, and then shopping places. He was a bit of a gambler in the early days. So he basically said, I'm going to go all out and do it really big time. And his gamble paid off.
It certainly did. In the latest Forbes list of the richest people on the planet, Wang Jialing came out ahead of the new tech billionaires like Alibaba's Jack Ma. How he built his $24 billion fortune personifies China's own route to riches. Wanda jumped into the real estate market that was privatized during the 1990s. It's hard to believe, but housing had been allocated since 1949 by the Chinese state that owned all of the assets in the country. For the first time, hundreds of millions of people could buy their homes after decades of central planning. After issuing shares to the public last year, Wanda became the largest listed company in real estate in China. It's a huge achievement for a private company in a nation where land is still state-owned.
Wanda is always trying to reinvent itself. We're constantly changing our business model. For example, we started with residential property and then we turned to business centers. Now, we're tapping into culture, finance, and even e-business. We're always innovating. This is because we are aware of the danger. We have a sense of crisis. This is what's galvanizing us to innovate.
His next big bet was on the growing consumer class. It was only a decade ago that China became a middle-income country. Wanda built the shopping complexes, hotels, and cinemas that cater to the new middle class. It was a clever move. Action-packed thrillers like The Man from Macau 2 filled Wanda cinemas over the Chinese New Year holiday this past February, the first month that China's box office takings overtook those in the United States. Wang Jieling has meanwhile turned to film production. The Wanda Studios in Qingdao will be China's answer to Hollywood. Stars flew in from L.A. for the launch a couple of years ago.
Please welcome Leonardo DiCaprio!
When it opens in 2017, it will be the world's largest film and television studio, complete with a temperature-controlled underwater stage. It seems the next phase of Wanda is, simply put, global domination.
We don't want to become another Disney. For one reason, Disney is too old. It already has an 80-year history. I don't want to be like that. I would like to create a brand new Wanda-style entertainment project. If I follow it, then I'll just be a second Disney, not as good. So I don't think we'll just copy it. We have our own ambition. We might even have a larger scale.
If all this seems a little grandiose, you have to remember that the super rich in China all came from nothing. Wealth was destroyed during the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. Its business tycoons are reminiscent of another nation where the industrialists were also self-made. Rupert Hoodworth again.
What we've seen happen in China the last, say, 20 years has probably been the most exciting moment in the history of entrepreneurship since at the very earliest, you know, the robber baron period of America 150 years ago, because you've seen an entire generation start from scratch.
But how much of this wealth is down to genuine business acumen? China is a one-party state, so anyone who rises to the top needs impeccable political connections. Is that personal network really the secret of Wang Jieling's success? He told me it only gets you so far.
If you look at private companies in China, those who are doing very well do not really use these connections. As long as a company uses personal connections, it usually can't be run at large scale. It might have big profit, but the scale won't be big. Those large companies, especially the ones like us, trying to be multinational company, cannot rely on personal connections. We mainly benefit from the market itself.
If Wang Jieling's success still seems a bit too good to be true, then there is always the question of debt. As economic growth slows to a mere 7% per year, debt is a big concern in China, and it's particularly a worry in real estate. Here again, the story of Wang Jieling mirrors that of China. Has he taken on too much risk? His sale of shares to the public earlier this year was expected to fetch more money. Rupert Hoodworth says it's much harder to get rich on real estate now than it used to be.
You know, there's more traditional industries like real estate and retail are undergoing some fundamental shifts. Yeah. And it's going to be very difficult for them to see the same growth as before.
Still thinking big, Wang Jieling isn't worried by questions about China's debt crisis and seems convinced his fortune is secure. In fact, he sees another privatization bonanza on the horizon.
We can only solve the debt problem by selling the land held by local governments. But how can we do that? I think we need to have those interested property companies to buy them. So solving the debt is the fundamental way of maintaining long-term smooth development of the property market. That's what I mean.
So far, nobody in China has benefited from the rapid liberalization of the economy more than Wang Jieling. He's built a hugely successful business anticipating the needs and desires of the emerging middle class. Their lives have also been transformed. But China is still a poor country, on a par with Peru in terms of GDP per head. I'm Linda Yu for the BBC.
Next week, we conclude our series in the U.S. I've been on the road in Silicon Valley this week, talking to folks about the middle class and mobility. What does the American dream look like to you? Come and tweet us at the hashtag #SixRoots. We just heard about China's swelling middle class. Chinese-born immigrants represented the third largest immigrant group here in the U.S. in 2013, according to the Migration Policy Institute. And that got us curious about Americans with roots in two places. Betty Ming Liu's parents immigrated to the United States in the mid-1940s to escape political turmoil in China. Betty grew up in New York's Chinatown, where her father owned a bookkeeping business.
Chinatown in those days, we're talking back in the 70s, it was really pure cash economy. It was the underground economy. Everybody carried cash. Everybody did business in cash. And at the end of the day, my father would take whatever money he made, he'd put it in a brown paper bag, a sandwich bag, and he'd put it in my little kid's school bag, and I would walk to the bank and deposit it for him. Because if he carried it himself, a man in a suit, the Chinese gangs would have robbed him. The little kid, I mean, I was like in the fourth grade with my little school bag and my nerdy little sparkle eyeglasses and my little corduroy jumper, but he'd be following me like half a block away to make sure I was okay. And then he'd watch me throw the sandwich bag, a brown paper bag, on the counter, and, you know, they count the cash and then we'd go home. My mom and dad are both immigrants and they're both Chinese, but my mom grew up in China. And my dad's people immigrated to South Vietnam, so he grew up in what was then called Saigon. The mindset, I don't think people can even imagine, unless you've lived through it, the difference between an immigrant parent and having an American-born mentality. So everything they controlled, they wanted it to be for the family. You had to do things for the family, get educated for the family. If I wanted to go out and have fun, that wasn't really good, because how does that serve the family? So study hard and serve the family. It is a lot of pressure. My father would pick my classes in college. Starting in high school, he would pick my classes. Fathers rule, at least in my family and in many families around me when I was growing up in Chinatown. There was no question. There were no sons. It was just me and my younger sister. So I switched my major to an accounting major. My dad had a little bookkeeping business in Chinatown, and I was expected to help my mom take care of the business. When he died when I was 19, that was when I finally started to make up my own mind about things. Happiness is a journey for someone like me because I wasn't raised to be happy. I was raised to be responsible. And after saying all the stuff about my parents, I do need to say something. What they wanted as immigrant parents for me was to teach me how to be a survivor. And that they did very, very well. You can't give what you never had. And it took me a long time to accept that. I can't blame my parents for what they could not give me, because if they never experienced it, how are they going to know how to give it to me? It's up to me. It's up to me to take what they gave me and figure out how to build on that and get what I want for myself.
Betty Ming Liu is a blogger, journalist, and professor in the New York City area. We heard earlier in our special BBC segment about the challenges of China's emerging middle class. It's had its ups and downs, but one thing that continues to grow are the number of websites and services that want a Chinese audience. But what happens when China blocks access to those sites? Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, joins me in a moment to explain.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
None shall pass.
What?
None shall pass.
I have no quarrel with you, good Sir Knight, but I must cross this bridge.
Then you shall die.
This is Tech,
in real life. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
All right, we're thinking and talking about blocked access, and we are talking a lot about China today on the show.
Uh-huh.
Obviously a topic that comes up when we think about blocked internet access. You've spent some time in China.
I have, Lizzie, though it was way back in 2002 and mercifully a few years before I actually depended heavily on the internet, and that's a good thing.
Okay, so explain sort of how China blocks access to a lot of the internet.
Okay, so there's actually a familiar term for this.
Okay, it's kind of a hackneyed term, but go ahead.
But we should at least list it. It's called being behind China's Great Firewall. The country has pretty stringent censorship of websites that might feature or deliver information that isn't in line with the Chinese government's narratives about a number of things. Government officials actually call this cyber sovereignty. Residents in China who are active on the country's various social networks have experienced this with internal blocking and censorship when protests or large news events happen in China. A lot of others experience this in a different way when they try and access parts of the internet outside of China. Google has definitely struggled with this as a company that's ostensibly geared around trying to offer information with usefulness as the only bias.
Hmm.
I've talked with journalists and others operating within the country who find a couple different ways of getting around this.
Give me some examples of things that are blocked.
Well, Google is blocked, for instance.
Right.
Access to Gmail, the New York Times, you might find is blocked. A lot of different media companies, even certain kinds of research.
And some social networks. Networking.
Yep, and some social networking. And there's a couple different ways that you can get around this in China. One way is the VPN, or the virtual private network. People use VPNs for all sorts of things, accessing your work email from an internet connection outside of your office, for instance. In China, it's about, you know, really getting access to the unfettered internet. That can mean all kinds of things. A VPN connects your computer to a computer outside of the country and pretends that you, the user, are in that country when you access information. So it can be kind of complicated to set up, and China is actually getting better at blocking VPNs and VPN sites. Another way is through what's called a proxy, which sort of acts like a browser window through which you kind of look to see something like the New York Times or Gmail. But there's also another kind of access blockage happening in China right now, and that's about foreign tech companies that want to operate in China.
What do you mean by that?
So this year, China has been reportedly blacklisting companies, among them Apple, Intel, Cisco, also some financial tech companies that want to operate as part of the country's banking systems.
China's a very lucrative place to do business. Huge market for these companies.
Yes, companies really...
If they can.
Exactly, and companies really want access to this booming economy. But China, in some cases, is sort of asking for the keys to the kingdom from these companies, saying, basically, we want to be able to go into your hardware, your software, and decrypt anything you've encrypted. Now, what that means to U.S. tech companies in some ways is China wants the ability to access intellectual property. And that makes U.S. tech companies nervous and Western tech companies nervous because that could be used to steal that intellectual property and then, I don't know, inform some of the growing number of tech companies that exist in China.
Of course, there's some irony here because the U.S. government has... in fact, been listening in on what those tech companies were doing as well.
And also some irony in that there are Chinese tech companies that want to operate in the U.S., and the U.S. government has actually been very outspoken about its nervousness about that.
Exactly.
So this is a debate that's controversial. It's continuing. I don't think it's going to be resolved anytime soon, but I think we're going to see more of it.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
If we're talking about things that are a little unclear or hard to figure out this week, you can add this story to the mix. The comeback of the cassette tape. Yeah, the real thing. And if you're a Metallica fan, this one's great news. The metal band is releasing a rare original demo on cassette. And there have been some anecdotal reports lately that, just like vinyl, cassettes are making a comeback among music lovers. So what's that all about? Oregon Public Broadcasting's John Sepulvedo met with some cassette enthusiasts to find out.
The way Popeye is about spinach or Jane Goodall is about chimpanzees, well, that's how Mike Haley is about cassette tapes. Haley lives in Wilmington, Delaware, and every few weeks or so, he gets his friends together and talks tapes.
And, you know, sit around and, you know, drink some beers, play some tapes, and ramble on about whatever dumb thing you can think about to critique a cassette tape. I think we've talked about it already.
Talked about it on his podcast. It's called Tabs Out, and it's all about tapes.
So number 58.
58.
And the music on it is all from cassettes. It's been going on for about 60 episodes now. At the same time, music labels, as big as Disney and as cool as Rough Trade, started issuing cassette tape releases too.
And for whatever reason, tapes just became a thing.
That's right. Music on cassette tapes is a thing. Disney sold about 2,500 copies of the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack on tape, according to Nielsen. Then there are labels like Burger Records. The indie company claims to have sold more than 300,000 cassette tapes since 2007. Okay. So you're saying to yourself, well, whatever. So some indie company sold 300,000 tapes. There's got to be like 300,000 hipsters driving those sales, right? Apparently not. No. What's driving those sales?
They're inexpensive.
That's right. It's not about cool. It's about cost.
It's cheap.
Cheap.
Cost matters to Jessica Bordeaux and Mark Swart. The couple not only owns Portland-based New Moss Records, they're also in the band Summer Cannibals. They've managed several cassette releases as business owners. And as Bordeaux explains, tapes are a low-risk gamble.
That was for us. Like, that was, it was like, we can't, like, we don't know realistically how many people are going to buy these. And so, what makes the most sense? Okay, we can do it digitally, but that's, we don't want to download cards on a merch table.
Just in case you're wondering, merch tables are where bands sell CDs, t-shirts, and yes, cassettes at a concert. They're a huge deal for working musicians. Good merch sales can be the difference between a tour that's successful or a tour that busts. But, Bordeaux says, there's another appeal to tapes. Because of the low costs, artists can get real weird if they want to.
We did an EP for Summer Cannibals, Make You Better, and I made all the packaging for the cassettes, and they would fold out, and, you know, like, that kind of stuff is fun, and I think that tapes do lend themselves to, like, more creative packaging than... Well, because a lot of the record stores aren't going to sell your tapes. And so you can kind of be more weird with them and creative.
That creativity can help keep super fans interested in a band. And for the music industry, those super fans really, really matter. According to Nielsen, which tracks music sales, super fans are the big spenders. About 75 cents of every music dollar comes from a super fan. So if a band, like Metallica, puts out rare or hard-to-get material... They know the broader audience may just shrug their shoulders, but the super fans will snatch it up. And if that material is on cassette with its high profit margins, cha-ching. And here's the other thing. For collectors, tapes are so much better than digital music, says Kill Rock Stars production manager James Reeling. He says you can actually hold them.
Because things have become so, like, disposable, when you see something that is so obviously not disposable, it's, like, has that much more appeal as something that's, like, kind of precious or special.
That tangibility isn't just appealing to music fans. Some data geeks are clamoring for these cassettes as well. That's because Sony, IBM, and other hardware companies have developed tapes that aren't your grandma's cassettes. These tapes can store 185 terabytes of data. To put that in perspective, that's all the printed collected works in the Library of Congress times 18 and a half. Graham McMillan writes for Wired magazine, and he says, yeah, you could store that amount of data digitally.
But if you have a glitch with your data, with your digital storage, it could be gone. Whereas with tape, it's tangible. It's right there.
So does all this mean we really have a cassette tape renaissance? No. Probably not. Even Mike Haley, the guy from Tabs Out podcast, doesn't think so. He says it's a thing right now, but it's a fad.
Metallica and Jeff Bridges are making like thousands and thousands of tapes or whatever. I think they'll eventually figure out that, like, this isn't really working. I think enough people wrote, like, think pieces about how cassettes are making a comeback to make people think that cassettes are making a comeback, when in reality, I think writing about cassettes is making a comeback.
Wait a minute. Writing about cassette tapes was once a thing? For Marketplace Weekend, I'm John Sepulveda in Portland.
Our show today with another story that's tied to clarity and figuring things out, with first impressions. When you first meet someone, do you smile, shake hands? Jack Schaefer is a former special agent with the FBI. He spent a chunk of his career as a behavior analyst. He says the same tricks he used as an agent can work at work. So what did Schaefer do with that knowledge of body language?
Basically, I caught spies. What we would do is determine whether they were telling us the truth or telling us a lie. And eventually, our goal was to convince those folks to work for us. Our brain constantly scans the environment looking for friend-foe signals. And we unconsciously give off friend signals. And the top three friend signals are the eyebrow flash, which is a quick up-and-down movement of the eyebrows. And that is a long-distance signal that tells the person you're approaching, I'm not a threat. And if the person you're approaching is not a threat, they reciprocate. The second friend signal is a head tilt. And when you tilt your head, you're exposing your carotid artery. And that's a very vulnerable part of your body because it delivers oxygen to your brain. And when that's cut off, you typically don't last too long. So basically what you're telling the other person is, I'm exposing a weak part of my body, a vulnerable part, and I trust that you won't hurt me. So when you tilt your head, people look more trustworthy, and they tend to like you more. And the last thing is the smile. When you smile, you get a shot of endorphin. And endorphin is the thing in your brain, the chemical in your brain that makes you feel good about yourself. And so when you smile and somebody smiles back at you, you're basically telling each other we're friends, but then you also get a good feeling about yourself. And the other person feels good about you. If you want people to like you, you make them feel good about themselves. And what's nice about this is you can do this in a long-term basis with a long-term relationship, or you can do it on a short-term basis when you meet clerks, when you meet wait staff, when you meet people you don't really know. Here's the thing job applicants often overlook. They're apprehensive when they go into job interviews. And when people are apprehensive, they're less likely to give off friend signals. So when you walk into a job interview, often you're going to have what I refer to as faux signals. And once you walk in that room, the person that's going to interview you sees those faux signals. They're going to say, something's not quite right with that person. They don't know exactly what it is, but they'll get the impression that the person's not friendly. Employers don't hire people they don't like. So what you want to do is make sure when you walk into interviews that you display these friend signals. Is it manipulative? If we're talking in terms of operational aspects to the FBI, yes. But it's interesting when you convert these things over to personal relationships, you can't force people to like you, and you can't continue a charade very long or the relationship is going to disintegrate. So in different circumstances, the tool can be used very effectively.
And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Jenny Ament, with help this week from Maxine Chapman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president.
Special thanks to KQED in San Francisco for hosting us this week. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. On next week's show, we take a look at the roots to riches here in the USA, in Silicon Valley, and the Silicon Valley of the last century. That's part of our continuing series with the BBC. Thanks for listening. This is APM.